Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics. Urban planning fascinates me. The ebb and flow of people, converted spaces and buildings, new construction, the range of commutes from nuisance to hellish, and the technology needed for this dynamic growth to continue. It ticks all the boxes. So, the new book, The Heart of the City, Creating Vibrant Downtowns for a New Century, was simply a must-get interview. Professor Alex Garvin wrote The Heart of the City. He's a professor at Yale University, but his experience runs deeper. Alex Garvin has combined a career in urban planning and real estate with teaching, architecture, and public service. He is now president and CEO of AGA, Public Realm Strategists Incorporated. It's a planning and design firm in New York City. And in the months after 9/11, he led the rebuild team. Okay, let's get into it.
This is Alexander Garvin. I call myself Alex, and I'm professor of urban planning and management at Yale University.
If I could go, first of all, thank you for joining me because I'm excited, and that's why I jumped in. If I could go back to college, I would be one of your students. I think that you have a very interesting and compelling space in the academic world, and I've been doing some research for this interview. How did you land here? What was the impetus behind this book right now?
What happened to me was that I went to Lower Manhattan to the opening of the new PATH Railroad Terminal. I had been in charge of rebuilding the World Trade Center in the first 15 months after 9/11, and I thought I knew everything about Lower Manhattan. I had been going there my whole life to meetings, to meet people, to look around. Lower Manhattan had been in decline during my entire adult life and childhood as well. This was 2 years ago, and I look around, and it's thriving. And I couldn't figure out what had happened. So I went home, and I looked up the numbers, and I discovered that although Lower Manhattan had lost 25% of its office space in the last 25 years, it now had 9,000 more private sector jobs. At first, I thought this is impossible, but I'm a trained architect. The amount of space we're using per worker has declined. It was 500 square feet in 1970. It's 150 today. What was happening was the Class B office space was being vacated by companies that moved into Class A space. Real estate developers were buying up the abandoned Class B buildings and converting them to housing. And as a result, Lower Manhattan now had more than 60,000 residents. So I asked myself, was this happening anywhere else? I decided the least likely was Los Angeles. The same thing, downtown Los Angeles. And then I began to look around, and I understood that there was a resurgence of a great number of downtowns in America, and I decided to write a book about it.
Great. And I've lived in several of the cities you use as examples. I've lived in Houston, Pittsburgh, PA, Los Angeles. Now, of course, I'm in San Francisco / Oakland in the Bay Area. Why don't we do this? Why don't we give the audience your definition of what is a downtown?
With pleasure. For me, a downtown is a high-density, mixed-use section of the city that produces the bulk of the jobs and taxes in that city. So that if you went, say, to downtown Philadelphia, it occupies 6% of the territory, but it produces 44% of the jobs.
Wow. Let's go to Houston real quick. Okay, so I lived in West Montrose, just on the edge of River Oaks. River Oaks is the gap community, the bedroom community.
I know where it is.
I know.
I have been there.
I know, right? And then, of course, just west of River Oaks is the Galleria. It's not what people typically think of when it comes to a downtown. But when I lived there, the reason we didn't stay in the Galleria area was because of a food desert. There wasn't a lot to eat. There wasn't a grocery store. There were restaurants. There was not grocery stores. Is that something typical that has been remedied?
I've been going to Post Oak Boulevard, where the Galleria is, since the late 1960s, and I've watched it be transformed. That was certainly true when I first went there. It's certainly not true today. There are restaurants. I had a lovely lunch in two different places. They are remodeling or have now completed the remodeling of Post Oak Boulevard, planting six rows of live oak. There are 180,000 people living within 3 miles of Post Oak Boulevard. And there are office buildings and, of course, the gallery itself, which is an attraction. And tourists, there are hotels everywhere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. When I was there, I left Houston in 2006, and the hotels had started to ramp up. I was there from 2000 to 2006. Okay, so that's one example of a non-typical, I mean, to the layman, a non-typical downtown, because it's not downtown Houston, which is where I used to work at the Houston Chronicle.
I explain in the book that many cities have more than one downtown. Houston has three.
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta has three. New York has many more than six or seven. But it is common. Philadelphia has two. There isn't a single downtown, and it isn't necessarily in the center of the city.
There are several chapters that really enthralled me, including Chapter 6, which is Lessons for Any Downtown. So let's come back to that one. I'm more interested, for the purposes of my audience, about the emerging 21st century downtowns, specifically the technology that could be involved in this. What did your research turn up there?
Well, when I tried to figure out when the change had begun, I identified 1990 as the flipping point for many cities.
Okay.
I already knew that in 1990 we had begun the proliferation of business improvement districts. I didn't think about, but I also knew that was the beginning of the perception of declining crime downtown. What I didn't expect was an invention, a technological factor that changed everything. It's the internet. The internet begins just about then. You don't need filing cabinets anymore. You don't need filing clerks anymore. You don't need the same kind of space. We now have WeWork and all kinds of organizations that supply space to entrepreneurs that could not have afforded it otherwise.
Interesting. Very interesting. And I guess I have a macro question to follow up. What is the psychological or emotional motivation for people to repopulate downtowns? Like you said, 1990 was a kind of a turning point. What was the attraction?
Price. If you were a young person emerging from college, you couldn't afford to buy a house with a big backyard in the suburbs. But you could afford to rent a space in one of the converted office buildings. And the result was that there began to be available space at a reasonable price. You didn't need to own a car in many of these downtowns because they had mass transit systems. And that meant the cost of living went down as well. That's a very direct economic explanation. I think, in addition to that, there are all sorts of things that we like to do now that are easy to do in a downtown and difficult to do if you're in a low-density suburb.
Are these people who moved downtown, are they going to stay downtown? Because obviously this is a cycle that you've noticed in your research. Prior to 1990, downtowns were empty. So
no, most downtowns were empty. That was not true of San Francisco. It wasn't true of New York. It wasn't true of Boston. And it wasn't true of Philadelphia. There were downtowns that had sizable downtown populations. They continued to grow. There were also downtowns that emptied out, like Detroit or St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And they are still struggling. So there are three trajectories, not just one.
Let's take St. Louis as my last question. What lessons would you extrapolate from other successful downtown conversions or sustainabilities to St. Louis? What should St. Louis be addressing policy-wise?
St. Louis has one very unusual situation. It has done many of the right things. It has a convention center. It has a remodeled Union Station that is now a shopping mall. It has the public library, the government offices downtown, and everything, including the stadia, are too far from one another. So you have to drive to one, and when you're finished, you get back in your car and you go home. If you need to create a downtown, you've got to be able to tie them all together. And that is what happened in Pittsburgh. That is what happened in Philadelphia.
Right.
Pittsburgh very specifically went about transforming its downtown in the 1950s, 1940s and 50s, and it's still doing the same. It now has a cultural district, which it didn't have in 1950. It has museums it didn't have. It has a downtown university, and it keeps renewing itself. That's what you need to do.
And the converted spaces in Pittsburgh, I lived there in the late 90s. On the weekends, I would go downtown and I would take pictures of buildings and I would be almost alone. But I went back and visited. I have friends who live there. And now you're totally right. Everything seems to hub around that cultural district. I couldn't imagine the development has been going on for this long. How can they sustain such a quick, how can they sustain such a development boom?
Well, when you have, and it's unusual in Pittsburgh because the price of housing in the suburbs is low. Despite that, there is all of this. There's things to do downtown that are what people are interested in. People have leisure time. That same cultural district is right next to the convention center, for example.
Right.
And so there's a spillover of these sorts of things. I won't say that Pittsburgh is perfection. It's not. But it has some things that have allowed it to keep renewing itself on a regular basis. Other cities like San Francisco or Boston or New York have been growing for centuries, and this is not stopping.
You are a professor at Yale, and I am just returned a couple weeks ago from my first visit to New Haven. Let's talk about a small city real quick. The only thing I saw from New Haven, honestly, off campus was aggressive panhandling. I didn't see a lot else going on. I also learned that New Haven is the first planned community or city in the United States. I don't know if that's true or not. I just heard it during a tour.
It's not true.
Okay.
Almost everything in the United States was planned, whether you're looking at Philadelphia or New York, all our cities, and everything going out west on the railroad, they were developed as new communities. But that's not the point. You asked about New Haven.
Right.
New Haven is in many ways unusual. The turning point in New Haven was the year 2000. It has a growing population now. There are people living downtown. You saw apartment houses and hotels that did not exist when I was an undergraduate. It started from many different sources. You have Ecuadorian immigrants. There is a consulate of Ecuador on State Street in New Haven. I would never have imagined that. There's a whole community in Fairhaven. You have new companies opening in new office buildings. There are a substantial number of these things. And yes, there is panhandling, but you'll find that in San Francisco, in New York. It is not unique to New Haven.
That's true. That's very true. Professor Alexander Garvin, his new book is The Heart of the City, Creating Vibrant Downtowns for a New Century. This has been my great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you. You ask wonderful questions.
Thank you, sir. That was Professor Alexander Garvin, who prefers Alex. He's a professor at Yale University, as well as president and CEO of AGA Public Realm Strategists Incorporated. It's a planning and design firm in New York City. For links to Mr. Garvin, the book, and his many projects, please check the show notes. They live at kgoradio.com/techonomics, or you can just scroll down in the podcast. Sincere thanks to Alex for sharing his time and experience, and to you for taking the time to listen. We hope you'll check out some other shows while you're here. For executive producer Lee Hammer, I'm the host and the writer, Jason Middleton. This has been Techonomics. Have great weeks, everybody.